Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 6th of March. First hour of our program today, we'll talk about this large medical news, a report that a 2.5-year-old baby from Mississippi appears to be cured of HIV. This has provoked intense interest. The toddler's case, if it is confirmed in research down the road, could really have important implications for treatment of more than 300,000 babies born with this virus every year, and most of those babies are born in the developing world. We'll be looking at what stands out about this particular case, and we will have two guests with us during the course of the hour. Dr. Rowena Johnston is Vice President and Director of Research at AMFAR, which is the Foundation for AIDS Research. This organization has been in existence for a number of years, 25 years, and they have invested all kinds of money in putting together numerous significant advances in HIV prevention, treatment, and care. It's helped expand, improve, and save the lives of countless people all over the world who are living with HIV, AIDS, or vulnerable to HIV infection. Later in the hour, Dr. Stephen Brown, Medical Director of the AIDS Research Alliance, will be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Rowena Johnston, hello, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with the circumstances, because they are rather unusual, of this 2.5-year-old in Mississippi.
Yeah, it is somewhat unusual for this to happen in the United States. This was a mother who presented at the hospital during labor, and she had not been in medical care during her pregnancy. She was administered a rapid HIV test during the process of labor and was determined to be HIV positive. The infant was born, and the pediatricians in question decided or knew that the infant was at fairly high risk for acquiring HIV infection, and so placed the baby girl on antiretroviral therapy, which is actually standard practice, but there was a difference here in one key respect. Standard practice would be to place the infant on a prophylactic regimen of antiretroviral therapy, the aim of which is to prevent HIV infection. What this pediatrician did was actually to put the baby straight onto a treatment dose of antiretroviral therapy, which is a higher dose, and she made this decision because she thought that this was actually probably in the best interests of the infant, and that treatment was started at about 30 hours after age, which is a lot earlier than what a baby would normally start antiretroviral treatment. And during the course of treatment during the next month or so, there were repeated tests, and we could see that the infant was responding well to antiretroviral therapy. During the next 18 months, the infant continued her antiretroviral therapy, but at 18 months was lost to medical follow-up. The mother and the child were no longer coming in to see the doctor. They did re-emerge at about 23 months, and the mother at that time did admit that the infant had not been taking antiretroviral therapy for at least 5 months. And so the pediatricians administered a viral load test, expecting that the virus levels would be very high, and actually didn't find any virus. And, you know, she initially thought that she had made an error, and so she redid that viral load test and again found that there was no virus to be detected. And that's the point at which she contacted her colleague, Dr. Catherine Lazuriaga, who in turn contacted her colleague, Dr. Deborah Persaud, both of whom were working in a collaboratory of researchers who were set up to investigate cases just like this. They had received an AMFAR grant to investigate potential cases of HIV cure and had very specialized techniques for looking at very low levels of virus. They all applied their expertise to this case and came collectively to the conclusion that this infant has now been cured.
So when you heard that news, did these two things, some researchers saying that it's within 31 hours and also the aggressive treatment, those were the factors that led to the cure?
Well, I think that's the leading hypothesis right now. And it is important to note, you know, this is a single case, mm-hmm. and it really does need to be followed up by rigorous research to see how generally applicable it is. But I think what does differentiate this case from others in the United States, where medical care is quite good, is that the treatment was started very soon after birth. Normally, an infant might start their treatment regimen at even as late as 6 weeks or more of age. I mean, 6 weeks is probably about as early as it would normally start. And so 30 hours really makes a very big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And what quite possibly happened here is that the treatments were started early enough that it meant that what we call reservoirs were not able to be established. And reservoirs is really kind of a term we use to talk about the virus that persists despite the fact that you're taking antiretroviral therapy. So there is always this hidden virus lurking in some very small number of cells that, you know, in adults and infants, frankly, for that matter, at this point in time, always prevents our ability to cure HIV infection. It's those reservoirs that stand between us and a cure. And they think that it's possible that having started the therapy so early after birth actually prevented the virus from being able to establish those reservoirs, and you know, over time, the virus that was there disappeared such that, you know, when she came back into care at 23 months of age, she does appear to have been cured.
Was there any question as to whether or not the baby was infected?
Oh, it's a hot topic of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that, you know, I think it's a very good thing for the scientific community to be skeptical, and I can tell you what was done in this case that I think makes a fairly compelling case that the infant was infected. The current guidelines for defining whether or not an infant has been infected after birth is to conduct two tests by what we call PCR. These are very sensitive tests that look for nucleic acids, and in this case they're looking for RNA and DNA for that matter, which do test for different types of infection. But the current guidelines mandate that you have two separate blood samples at two different time points and that both of those are positive for nucleic acids. And that was, in fact, the case for this child. And so she absolutely meets current guidelines for saying that she was infected after birth. Moreover, during the next few weeks after that infection was confirmed and she was placed on antiretroviral therapy, she had subsequent viral load tests monitoring how well she was responding to antiretroviral therapy. And for, I think, those four or five initial viral load tests also all came back positive and also indicated that during those first 3 weeks or so of life, her virus levels were decreasing, which is exactly what you would expect if she's responding well to antiretroviral therapy. So I think taking all of these factors together, I think it does make a compelling case that she truly was infected.
So the baby is 2.5 years now. Do we know for a fact that the baby is completely cured and at the age of 5 or 10 or 15 this virus would not reappear?
You know, we don't know that for a fact. I think it's very hard to use science to predict the future
mm-hmm.
in that kind of a way. What I can tell you is that some of the tests that have been conducted, very ultra-sensitive tests looking for DNA, for example, indicating that some cells are infected, some of those tests have indicated that there may be fragments of the virus still in the infant's body. And I think there are two interesting things to say about that. I think, number one, it's possible that that's further confirmation that there ever was a viral infection in there if there are still fragments of it present in her body. But second, if these are fragments, then they are not what we would consider or call replication competent. That is, you know, this, if it's only pieces of the virus and not the whole virus, then that virus would not be able to reproduce itself and then reseed an infection in this infant. Having said all of that, I think, you know, it certainly is a case where we are going to have to wait and see. It's one of the ultimate difficulties, really, of determining whether anybody is cured of HIV infection, because you could always, if you were very skeptical, make the hypothesis that this viral infection may reappear tomorrow. And, you know, that's something that would be very hard to disprove at any particular time point. Of course, this case is so interesting that we can be sure that this child will be followed very closely.
Oh, yes, very closely. So does it mean, or is this not a possibility at all, that if you caught an HIV virus in an adult or in a young person very, very early and gave the same kind of treatment, you might have the same results or not?
You know, again, there are a couple of interesting things to say about that. The adult immune system is significantly different from an infant immune system, and I think from that perspective alone, it would be difficult to generalize these results from infants into adults, because the immune system is in a very immature state and is not really fully functional when an infant is born, and I think that possibly contributed quite heavily to this case. But I will say that actually there are researchers around the world who have identified people very, very soon after infection. And those people did start aggressive full-dose treatment regimens very soon after their infection. And after several years of having been on therapy, for one reason or another, they decided to take themselves off therapy. And those are people who actually do control their, well, to a large extent, or at least often, those are people who can control their viral infection very well in the absence of antiretroviral therapy. But what's different with those people is that using the same kinds of very sensitive tests that were used on this infant, people can, in fact, detect that viral infection is still there. So it's relatively good news for those adults who can start therapy very, very early after infection, because it is possible that you could reach a state where you're controlling your infection very well, but not seemingly to the extent that this infant has.
I know that the Foundation for AIDS Research pioneered really the research that led to the use of antiviral drugs to block mother-to-infant HIV transmission. So this case that we're seeing in Mississippi is unusual. Is it fair to say that most of the industrialized world does not see AIDS in infants, but this is huge news for the developing world?
Well, I think, you know, you're absolutely right that in those countries that have a great medical infrastructure, like the United States to a large extent, most women do present for medical care during pregnancy. They would be administered an HIV test, and if they were HIV positive, they would be recommended to go on a prophylactic regimen to reduce the chances of passing the HIV to their infant. Having said that, the most effective regimens we have, which are very, very good, still do allow for 1 to 2% of infants to be born HIV positive, even though the mother and the infant takes prophylaxis. So there are, in the United States, for example, around 200 infants born each year with HIV, despite the fact that we have this very good infrastructure in place. But as you point out, around the world, there are more than 330,000 infants born with HIV, partly because we don't have the infrastructure to reach the mothers. And I think one of the interesting implications of this research is that it's possible, pending confirmation with further research, that if we have a situation where a mother presents during labor and she hasn't taken prophylaxis during pregnancy, then all may not be lost. It's possible that maybe we're going to be able to intervene after the child is born. And, you know, for some circumscribed length of time, the child takes the antiretroviral therapy and then is spared a lifetime of HIV infection and antiretroviral therapy.
So what do people like you do with this presentation of this infant? What research needs to happen, and what breakthroughs may have happened as a result of this?
I can tell you that these researchers in question, Drs. Persaud and Luzuriaga, are very interested, first and foremost, in confirming these results in a larger group of infants. And they are very well connected both to, you know, to research networks, both in the United States as well as internationally, where they're going to have access to the research infrastructure that will be required to identify infants who may fall into this category. And I think once we have, you know, even a few more cases where we can confirm that this can be a possibility for other infants and that there's nothing particular about this one infant, you know, then that has policy implications for, you know, we need to ask ourselves, what is our policy on treating infant infection? Because, you know, as I say, right now the recommendation is to give the prophylactic dose, but I think it could have really vast ramifications if we find that, in fact, a treatment dose for just a couple of years, you know, spares, you know, the social and psychological costs of lifetime infection, as well as, you know, frankly, the economic costs of giving people antiretroviral therapy for a lifetime.
And that aggressive early treatment, as you say, could have significant cost considerations in countries that are quite poor.
Absolutely. No question. I mean, of course, I mean, we are talking also about the social and psychological effects of a lifetime of infection, but for those people who are paying for programs and who need to look at the costs of this, you know, it's estimated in the United States, for example, a lifetime of treatment of HIV infection does cost in excess of $600,000. And if you start multiplying that by 330,000 infants every year, I mean, those costs certainly add up.
Well, welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just a moment. Our guest the first half hour of the show is Dr. Rowena Johnston, Vice President and Director of Research at the Foundation for AIDS Research. They have been in existence for 25 years and really have been at the forefront of prevention, vaccines, clinical studies, new treatments. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email, use that if you'd like, talk@WPR.org, or go to our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, another in our continuing series of conversations about American presidents. This conversation will be about our 30th president, Silent Cal, Calvin Coolidge. Our guest has written a very thorough biography of Calvin Coolidge and believes that it's important for us to know more about this forgotten president. Let's go to phone calls now for Dr. Rowena Johnston. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Kelly in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I have a question. I'm just a little confused. I thought that babies born to moms with HIV here in the U.S. that do get the prophylactic treatment, their babies are sometimes born with a positive HIV test because of the passive immunity. And then they kind of convert because there has been that prophylaxis. So I'm confused as to why we wouldn't call that positive HIV test right at birth and then it converts, why we don't call all those cases cures then as well. Maybe I'm misunderstanding that, but I'm just confused.
Thanks, Kelly. You're asking an excellent question. And one of the things, and you're absolutely right, when a baby is born to an HIV-positive mother, the baby, strictly speaking, would always test HIV-positive. And that's by standard HIV tests. And the reason for that is that a standard HIV test that any adult might walk into a clinic, for example, to get actually tests for antibodies and not the virus itself. And, you know, the infants are always born with the mother's antibodies. And so if you administer a standard HIV test to a baby, it will always test positive whether or not it's actually infected because it has its mother's antibodies. And, you know, pediatricians have known that for a very long time. And so they've had to develop different types of tests to test babies soon after birth. And that's what these very sensitive PCR tests are that look for both DNA and RNA, because they're looking specifically for the virus itself and not for the antibodies to the virus. So if the virus itself is in there, then you can conclude with a lot more certainty that the baby is actually infected.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Can you tell me a little bit more about what these aggressive treatments are for young babies? How are they administered? What exactly is in the treatment?
Well, you know, I guess I'm a little concerned by calling it aggressive. I think, first of all, I'll tell you that a baby can be put on prophylaxis, and those are, you know, standard antiretroviral therapy for the most part, with the exception that it's a relatively low dose of one drug called nevirapine that has been shown to be very effective at preventing HIV transmission from mother to infant. What happened here is that the baby was put on a very standard dose of antiretroviral therapy that you would put an infant on, except that she was put on, you know, she was put on this treatment dose. It was the standard antiretroviral regimen of treatment that would be given to a baby, but not normally given to a baby until at least 6 weeks of age.
I see. Bill in Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I have a question and a comment. The question is, are there other routes being pursued, types of research being pursued that would perhaps provide something like the polio vaccine that is easy to administer and has helped, I think, eradicate polio from many parts of the world. The comment is my brother passed away in 1990 at age 40 from HIV, and a colleague at work in New York suggested that I consider donating to AMFAR, and I have been for the 23 years since. So it does pay off, I guess, doesn't it?
Oh, thank you, Bill. I'm very sorry to hear about your brother, but we're very thankful to you for supporting us, because it is donations from our supporters that allows us to support this kind of research. But as for your question about, for example, the development of a vaccine, you know, certainly vaccine research is of critical importance, and I think it's going to be an absolutely vital element to bringing an end to the international AIDS pandemic. But, you know, so vaccine research is normally thought of as preventing the infection in the first place.
And, you know, we do actually have very effective ways of preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV that does not involve a vaccine. And it's what we've been talking about in terms of putting the mother on antiretroviral therapy during pregnancy and then treating the infant with this low dose of prophylactic antiretroviral therapy after birth. And when that is done properly, it's at least 98% effective in preventing transmission. And by the way, you know, 98% is actually more effective than almost any vaccine that we have. So in this particular setting, preventing mother-to-child transmission is something that we have a very effective means of doing, but around the world, that is not necessarily available at the level that we'd like it to be. And, you know, even under the best of circumstances, we do still see, you know, 1% to 2% of infants born with HIV despite having undergone absolutely the best medical care.
Well, thank you for the answer. That's very good.
Thank you, Bill, so much for your call. Lars in beautiful Cable, Wisconsin. Hi, Lars.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, I used to work at the University of Madison in the pharmacy making oncology drugs. And a lot of them were really toxic, and I know that some of them became the antiretroviral drugs you're talking about. I'm just wondering, how safe is it to give a newborn baby, you know, without a fully developed immune system, these really toxic drugs? And anyway, I never hear anyone talk about that.
Yeah, that's a fair question. And in the early days, the antiretroviral therapy regimens were more toxic than they are today. So keep in mind, you know, our first antiretroviral drug came out in 1987, and we've had, you know, 25-plus years since then to be able to improve both how effective the drugs are as well as to decrease, you know, to really play with what kinds of doses can be effective and also have the least toxicity. But it's worth remembering that, I mean, there are no drugs that treat any diseases that are without toxicity of some kind. And, you know, one of the really, I guess, hopeful messages of this case, if we can generalize this to other infants and that they end up really spending only a year or two, for example, of life on antiretroviral therapy, then not only are we sparing them a lifetime of HIV infection and antiretroviral therapy, but we're also potentially sparing them all of the toxicities that do go along with antiretroviral therapy. They are not as dire as they once were, but they certainly are significant enough that nobody should take lightly the idea of, you know, spending a lifetime on antiretroviral therapy.
Thanks, Lars, very much for your call. Bill mentioned the work that you are doing and his contributions to AMFAR. Give me just a little idea of the scope of the work of AMFAR. It is so wide, isn't it?
It sure is. We have a research program, and 7 of every $8 that we invest in research actually goes directly to cure research, because we are dedicated to finding a cure for HIV, and we've been doing that for over 10 years, during which time, you know, people were not convinced that a cure was going to be possible, and AMFAR has always thought that we're going to be able to find a cure for HIV infection. We've been supporting all of the key researchers in this area for a very long time. We have a collaboratory of researchers, a consortium of people who work together and who all bring their expertise to this problem and looking at it from different perspectives, which I think, you know, lends this valuable additional, you know, really effort and importance and the ability to identify these new findings and to really act upon them quickly. In the other areas, we also have an international research program where we're looking at HIV and AIDS in Asia and the rollout of antiretroviral therapy there and how one can best do that in the types of settings that don't have as many resources as, for example, the United States. We also have a public policy program that advocates for the appropriate amount of investment in biomedical research so that all of this important research can be done. And we have a program that really addresses the challenges that are being faced by gay men in the developing world and how it is that they should fight for their rights and for access to treatment, because we know that they're really an underserved population who, you know, to some extent even criminalized. And, you know, we really need to address this epidemic not only from a biomedical perspective but also from a human rights perspective.
Mm-hmm. That's been a continuing issue ever since the virus was first discovered, hasn't it? Thank you very Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Johnson. You were so informative. Thanks. Dr. Rowena Johnston, Vice President and Director of Research at AMFAR, which is the Foundation for AIDS Research. We continue our conversation now. Dr. Stephen Brown is joining us, the second part of the hour. He's been the Medical Director at AIDS Research Alliance since 1997 and also Vice President since 2007. He has been the driving force in the work to develop Prostratin, and his commitment to research led to AIDS Research Alliance to becoming an investigational site with the HIV Vaccine Trials Network. He has been principal investigator for over 120 clinical trials. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Brown. Our phone number remaining, of course, the same, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Stephen Brown, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, good morning. I'm very glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. Let's start with what caught our attention, and that was that Mississippi baby evidently cured. How important a medical story is that? Will that be?
Well, I think it's very, very important. I've been listening, of course, to the first half of the program and the research that has been mentioned by Dr. Johnson, that is supported in part by AMFAR. And I think that for many people, the idea of a cure for HIV has been a kind of a pipe dream, something seen as impossible for quite some time. And for those of us who've been in the trenches for a long period of time and looking at ways to potentially achieve these ends, this is extremely, extremely gratifying to see that there are some, seems to be some progress being made.
And why? I'm sorry.
I do think it's a little interesting that, you know, two of the largest advances in, or, you know, cures to date have not necessarily come out of the big research institutions. So while there have been collaborations, the initial work that was done with the Berlin patient came out of, you know, the universities of Germany. And, of course, here this research initially came out of Mississippi, which is not exactly places where our largest efforts are being made in cure research.
So what kind of research needs to happen now as a result of learning about this baby? Where do you go from here?
Well, when we think about how we would approach a cure strategy and what strategies we would use, we think about the kinds of cases where reservoirs that are the cells where the virus is hidden, where the virus is resting and kind of impervious to our interventions, we think about those cases where those reservoirs are particularly small. And so the two cases that have come to date, the Berlin patient who's had two bone marrow transplants where basically his bone marrow was basically obliterated and then replaced, and a baby who's began treatment very, very, you know, very early, before a reservoir could really be established. These are the kinds of cases where we would expect to see some early results for trying to minimize the reservoir and approach a state where there's either some kind of functional cure or a remission of sorts where the virus doesn't replicate.
I'm having a hard time understanding what that reservoir is. Can you tell me where it is in the body, what it looks like?
Yeah, so going back to our biology, you know, in high school, which we all took, just a reminder that, you know, viruses by themselves can't really do very much to harm us. They actually need to hijack the machinery of our cells. And HIV in particular has another second kind of nasty trick that it does, is that as part of its life cycle, it actually becomes part of the DNA of our cells. It sounds really kind of creepy, and it is actually creepy. And so at that particular point, the virus exists not necessarily as a virus, but only as the information necessary to make the virus. And so the cells where the virus is integrated into the DNA do not necessarily express at that time these any of the viral proteins that would alert our immune system that tell it that, you know, look, there's something going on, the cell is infected. And these cells that have an integrated virus are the reservoir. And they're primarily blood cells. They're primarily T cells, but they probably exist in different kinds of cells throughout the body. And there's a lot of discussion going on about how relevant certain locations are in addition to certain types of cells. So we know that there are some in the bone marrow, there's some in the lymph nodes. There's discussion about whether some of these cells in the brain are latently infected and are reservoir cells, and I think a lot of people agree that does take place. So they can be spread throughout the body in different kinds of cells. Different kinds of cells and different kinds of locations.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're there, they're hidden, and they're silent. And so when we talk about someone going on medication and becoming undetectable, they are indeed undetectable, but there is still a reservoir of these cells throughout the body. And it could be perhaps as little as 1 million to 10 million cells that remain infected. And as long as they're in this kind of quiet state where they're kind of hanging low and incorporated in our DNA, the medications we use generally don't work.
I see. When you said earlier that we thought, and many still think, that it's a cure for HIV seems to be an impossibility, why have we thought that for quite some time?
I've been in the trenches since the 80s, and the opinion has gone back and forth quite dramatically over the years. So when the cocktail first came out, there was a lot of hope that the cells in the body would be constantly active and producing virus, and that these medications would cause the cells to die off, and the cells that are infected would gradually die off. But it turns out that these reservoir cells are very, very long-lived, and they don't turn over. And, though the amount of virus plummets in the periphery, that is in the blood particularly, 98% of the virus is anticipated to not be actually in the blood. It's in the lymph nodes.
Hmm.
So when the first medication, as I said, came out, we saw this plummeting of virus, and we assumed that plummeting would occur everywhere, and that therefore, the virus would be eliminated. But it turns out that sharp reduction we see with the therapies does not occur everywhere and in all cells. And in these cells in these quiet states that are sitting and lurking, there's no replication, and so they in effect don't decay. They don't. The reservoir doesn't, basically leak out very, very much over the years, so that, over a period of 10 years or 20 years, there's very, very little reduction in this remaining, 10 million reservoir cells.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the driving force. You were the driving force to develop Prostratin. What is that?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. It was originally discovered... It was used as a botanical in Samoa, and was used by the healers there.
Hmm.
And it was brought back to National Cancer Institute via Dr. Cox, who was doing some research on ethnobotanicals. And what a lot of people don't know is that the National Cancer Institute has this large repository of chemicals from all over the world. And when HIV came along, they began testing their chemicals against HIV, and that's, of course, how one of the first ones, AZT, popped up. But Prostratin also popped up as an anti-HIV agent. And it was put on the fast track for development, but then it was discovered that it also caused virus to replicate. It activated cells that had the virus, and when you activate cells with virus, they tend to replicate and create more virus. And so early in the epidemic, before we had suppressive therapy, this was a very unpleasant and unwelcome finding. So the drug was tasked and basically put on the shelf for a long period of time. But at AIDS Research Alliance in Los Angeles, when I took over the position, one of the things the organization was interested in, and this goes back to 97, was we were looking at things that could potentially trigger replication in these cells. We anticipated that somewhere down the line, looking at the pipeline, there would be a lot of medications that might be available and that we would be able to stop replication. And we saw that there was a potential for this reservoir to continue, and we wanted to start looking at ways of doing or curbing this reservoir very, very early. And, of course, people thought we were kind of out there and we were howling in the woods. But we in-licensed the drug from NIH. We were the first nonprofit to in-license a drug from NIH, and we've been trying to bring it through the pipeline, through the animal testing that's necessary in order to move it into the clinic.
Hmm.
It may not be one of the best medications out there to move in this way, but it is fairly far along, although, funding definitely inhibits our ability to get it into the clinic.
Is it unusual to find a botanical from a Somalian healer? I mean, how did that happen even?
Well, I mean, if you look at a lot of our medications that are currently used, a lot of them have had roots in botanicals, so or that have been derived from nature. So, aspirin comes from bark. We get digitalis from foxglove. There's a new medication for HIV diarrhea called crofelemer that we were involved in doing clinical trials on for nearly a decade, was just approved by the FDA for the treatment of HIV-associated diarrhea and is also in use in India for treatment of cholera, which is a big problem. So it's not unusual to find something derived from a botanical or from natural compounds that are later developed and turned into or modified or tweaked. A lot of that really has to do with patent law and how pharmaceutical companies, their business model is making money. It's not really possible to patent a natural compound, but so they don't get quite the protection. But there are a lot of medications currently in use. Another one is Taxol, which
right.
is used for breast cancer. So there's a lot of stuff out there that, depending on who you listen to, there are large estimates of what amount of medications have been derived from botanical or some other kind of natural source that have been developed and led to drugs.
Let me sharpen the question. Would it be unusual, though, to find out about those drugs by going to a healer? Is that a natural place to find out about them?
There's certainly a wealth of information that is held by natural healers around the world, and Dr. Cox at that time had received a MacArthur grant to collect botanical samples, and so he spent quite some time on Samoa talking to the healers, and they used a large variety of things, and he sent a lot of stuff back to National Cancer Institute.
Fascinating.
He was motivated primarily from an interest in cancer, which had unfortunately taken his mother, and there was a lot of botanicals and things, and what was fortunate about this, I mean, they tested pastrapin against cancer, and it didn't do anything, but, there was a chemical entity identified, and it was purified, and recently, in the last 5 years, a way to produce it cheaply has been determined and developed by researchers at Stanford, and so it's it would be something that we could put into humans as soon as we get the clinical trial, preclinical work done.
Dr. Stephen Brown, our guest this half hour, he's medical director of the AIDS Research Alliance. We welcome phone calls for him if you would like to join the conversation. We've broadened it somewhat from the Mississippi baby, the 2.5-year-old who was found to be cured of AIDS, which was making big medical news, but we're looking at possible cures. We're looking at a lot of issues with Dr. Stephen Brown. I'd like to talk more about where we're seeing more cases of HIV/AIDS in the world. What are the populations still at great risk? And where have we made great strides? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And the Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, that's okay, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, a new book on our 30th president, Calvin Coolidge, who our guest says, she is the author of this biography, has been ignored. And she says he's remained obscure because of a love story and two principles. We'll talk about that and a lot more about Calvin Coolidge, Silent Cal, after the news. This hour, we're talking about AIDS and looking at the medical discovery of the baby who had been cured in Mississippi, and we're going a little bit beyond that conversation with Dr. Stephen Brown, medical director at the AIDS Research Alliance. Our phone number, join us if you would like, 800-486-8655. Give us, if you could please, Dr. Brown, an overview of the AIDS epidemic, where we're seeing a lot of new cases and where we have made great strides.
Well, I have to agree, we have made great strides around the world, but it still is an issue. In the United States, there's about probably a little over a million people living with HIV, and one of the main issues is that 18 to 20% of people don't know that they're infected, and so every year, we think that there are approximately 50,000 people in the U.S. who continue to get infected. And this, in the U.S., it's really moving into, and has been moving into quite some time, into minority communities. So for the face of HIV now is very often a minority woman. So the racial groups most affected is African-Americans, which account for about 44% of all new infections, even though they only represent about 13% of the population. But for the first time, new infections among African-American women decreased in 2010. And so there's some improvement. But there is continued infections occurring among black men who represent about black men, bi men, and men having sex with men represent about 72% of new infections, and 36% of new infections of all men having sex with men. So there's still some, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. There are some advances that have been made, particularly in the use of what's called PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, where studies have shown that by taking HIV meds, these are HIV negative people who are taking HIV meds on a daily basis, and if they consistently take them, they can reduce their risk of infection quite substantially. It depends a little bit on the population, but the FDA did approve the use of these HIV medications in certain populations in the United States, so that's a cause for some, joy or happiness, or that we're making some strides. There does seem to be some stabilization across the world in terms of infections, and new surveillance methods have allowed us to see that more accurately the infection rate across the world. But there are areas where it's still exploding, particularly Russia and other areas where things don't look quite as good.
Why in Russia?
Oh, well, there's any place you have a you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a drug problem.
I see.
But I mean, in terms of returning now back to, you know, the topic that we started, you know, our procedures in the United States protect babies about 95% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it used to be that there were a lot of infants born, and, you know, there are people now in their 30s who are infected as infants and have, you know, been able to, with the new medications, live to that particular age. But, you know, going back into the 80s, there was quite a problem with infected children. So now that we have testing, routine testing during pregnancy and treatment with kind of a mild cocktail throughout that pregnancy, reducing the number of infections in the United States is rather dramatic in terms of children.
Yes. And what about in the rest of the world? Is it still a continuing problem? Are there resources available?
Well, of course, going back to George Bush's PEPFAR program, I think, notwithstanding other areas, there's a lot of credit that administration can take for making HIV medication more relevant around the world, more easily available. Certain countries have really moved to the fore. I think Brazil was kind of annoyed all the pharmaceutical companies, but they really moved fairly quickly to make sure that the cocktail would be available. And some of the medications are now available in generic forms. And so you have medication cocktails that can be created, you know, by pharmaceutical companies overseas, where we're talking about basically administrations of medications costing, you know, around $1, $2 a day, as opposed to, you know, initially when we were talking $800,000, $1,400 a month.
A Facebook comment from Jennifer, going back to the baby in Mississippi. Is the baby's immune system abolished from such harsh treatment? If so, what implications will this have on the child later in life? Will they be on lifelong antibiotics?
Well, that's actually a very good question. I mean, certainly there are toxicities associated with the medication. But remember now that the infant has been off the medication, and one of the things about the immune system in HIV positives and others is that the immune system does a fairly good job of reconstituting itself. And in general, the younger you are, the better your reconstitution of your immune system. So there may be some minor issues that I would anticipate, and of course no one's really looked down the future, but I wouldn't anticipate major deficits. I'm sure they'll be looking at the repertoire of immune activity of the child, but I would expect it would, you know, if this remission is permanent, I would expect it to live a normal, healthy life.
And how would you know, as a doctor, when you could take a baby off these drugs? I mean, the mother did it just by herself.
Well, you wouldn't necessarily know. So that's the point of research. We would need to necessarily do clinical studies. And importantly, in this case, the infant received a fairly substantial cocktail, as opposed to the normal practice. And so more research needs to be done where this is done in a controlled setting, and probably research like this, you know, would most likely need to be done probably in places, where there is more infant infections or yet still a good research platform.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly more research is needed. I think there are still questions about whether this is actually a cure or whether,
right.
If there is, they have found, you know, some of the DNA of the virus is still present, and the DNA contains the instructions, but whether it contains all of the instructions I mentioned earlier that, you know,
we have to end on that note because we are out of time. There are questions remaining. Dr. Stephen Brown, thank you ever so much for being with us, Medical Director of the AIDS Research Alliance. And we also thank Dr. Rowena Johnston, Vice President and Director of Research at MFAR. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Amanda Magnus for producing this program, Katie Madsen for on-air production in Milwaukee.